Accession number 16673, Reel 2.
Mr. Aylard, Reel 2.
Consequently, we aimed not to go into that area if it was at all possible, and we were then endeavouring to heave to, as is the nautical phrase, which means that you try to stay in one spot, which is you point the ship into the wind and the sea and set the engines at a very, very slow speed so that as fast as the storm tries to push you back, the engines bring you forward. This is the way one hopes not to get swept into areas of danger. Well, we did get a very rough period, 24 or 36 hours, where we were hove to, and then the first lieutenant of the airship, Lieutenant Elston, managed to get a sight of a star through a break in the clouds, and due to his knowledge of exactly which star it was and working out the bearings and so on, he was enabled us to see whether we were near or far from these rocky areas, and it gave us a very good clue as to which direction to sail. We then made our way towards the port of Reykjavik, which is on the southwest coast of Iceland, just round the corner coming from the south. However, our problems weren't over, as we were sailing on in what was then quieter waters, thinking that we were heading for Reykjavik. And I was on duty at between 4 and 8 in the morning, and as I say, the storm had then abated, and we were approaching land, but we weren't not in sight of land, and consequently I was warned to proceed at slow speed and to keep my eyes open. And to my amazement, I saw breaking of the sea. In other words, as you approach the coast, one always sees little breakers in the water, little areas of white, which indicate shallow water. I couldn't see any land, and there was no indication that we were in shallow waters. But, however, this immediately warned me that all was not well to continue in that direction. So I immediately reversed the course of the ship 180 degrees so that we went back exactly the way we had come. In other words, we knew that it was safe to approach the coast on a certain line. Therefore, we hoped that it would be safe to leave on the same line and not to go dashing off left or right. Well, we immediately summoned the commanding officer, Lieutenant Gradwell, and we then kept a very close watch and steered away from this area of broken water. Eventually, we got another sight and realised precisely where we were and arrived in Reykjavik some 24 hours later, to be met with people who said, "We had written you off and we considered that you've been sunk for 3 days." So it was a lot of rejoicing all round, and messages were passed back to our base in Greenock that the Ayrshire was not sunk, although other ships had come to grief. I don't think any ship was actually lost in this very bad storm, but when we entered the harbour of Reykjavik, we saw that the effect that the storm had had on the ships that were anchored, and they were in great trouble, having been swept away. Despite their having anchors down, the storm was such that the anchors were not sufficient to hold the ships, and several ships had gone aground. So even if we'd made our way to the port, we could have had been in a similar problem to the ships that were already there.
What date approximately was that?
This was in January or February 1942, and we had, of course, to give a full account of this to the captain back in the base at Greenock. And we reported that the barometer had sunk as low as 27.3 inches, which is an exceedingly low reading. When we got back, the Captain D at Greenock said, "How do we measure this?" And we said we had a small aneroid barometer. And he said, "Oh, I don't think that's probably very accurate. You better take a reading at midday today and let me know what it says." And we did report this back and found that our little aneroid barometer was exactly on course for what it should have said. So we did actually enter an area of exceedingly low pressure. This fully supported the height of the storm. In other words, if you get this terribly low pressure, you do get storms with it.
And your job in the ship?
Well, my job was, I was one of two sub-lieutenants. We had Captain Gradwell, who before the war had been a barrister in Liverpool. The first lieutenant was Lieutenant Dick Elston, and he was a solicitor from London, but who had lived in Liverpool area, I think, in his early years. And there was myself and another sub-lieutenant, sub-lieutenant Jimmy Woods, who was Welsh, as one might imagine, and a very excellent friend. We were a typical number of officers in our background, typical of the fact that we were very mixed, and also, of course, from almost completely civilian life. Both Lieutenant Gradwell and Lieutenant Elson had been in the RMBR before the war, and had had considerable sailing experience, but it was the first time that either of them, I think, had been in an HM ship in command, or as first lieutenant.
What happened to you next in the ship?
Well, we then, that was in early 42, around that time, we were told that we were on the list for Russian convoys, and this meant that we had to go into dock in order that the ship could be made as windproof and as cold-proof as possible, and also that we could have supplies of steam hoses on the upper deck, so that if, as was quite possible, we would get iced up. In other words, the sea would come over the ship and the water would freeze, and consequently, if you had a lot of ice on the upper deck of the ship, or on the fittings and part of the superstructure of the ship, she could turn over because of the weight, and you had to have the steam hoses in order to melt ice if this condition appeared. Of course, naturally, when you heard that the ship was on the list for Russian convoys, everybody immediately, the morale dropped a few pegs, because the thought of facing the Arctic winter was bad enough, but to have to do it when you were being harried and chased by German U-boats and aircraft, and also the thought that if any action should take place, there was a very good chance that you wouldn't survive, because of course the waters were so cold that possibility of surviving in that sort of area was pretty slim. However, we, having been fitted out, were then sent to Iceland to carry out convoy duties, pending the time when the next convoy would be collected together. In other words, ships had to arrive in Iceland from America and from UK in sufficient numbers in order to justify a convoy being sent. And of course, not only had you get all the merchant ships together, you had to get a very strong escort force. And although we arrived in Iceland possibly in March 1942, it wasn't until June, I think, because I'm just trying to work out exactly when we left. I think we left on Pico 17 towards the end of June.
Yes, I think that's right.
And we initially encountered just a bit of fog and that sort of thing, cold weather. But being June, of course, it was very good visibility and at almost 24 hours daylight. Iceland is just south of the Arctic Circle, so there is a very short period in the night, but perhaps sort of between 1 and 2 in the morning when it gets quite dark, but it's a very short period. And of course, as we proceeded north, so it became daylight right round the clock, 24 hours, which of course doesn't make it any easier for a convoy to proceed unnoticed by the Germans if you've got 24 hours daylight. We were sighted fairly soon by German aircraft, and there were constantly in attendance. We had a German spotting plane, which was a large German seaplane built by a firm called Blohm, B-L-O-H-M, and Voss, Blohm and Voss. I think it was a 222, that was the description of it. Anyway, it was a large twin-engined German spotter plane, and with very long endurance. And this thing used to fly round and round the convoy very slowly, keeping an eye on exactly what was going on, and, of course, sending homing signals to German submarines to say that where the convoy was, which, of course, made life very difficult. A large escort force had been produced, which would be much larger than was the case for a normal transatlantic convoy. There would be not only ships from the Western Approaches Force, which was occupied very largely on convoy duties, but also ships from the Home Fleet based at Scapa would be sent. And these, of course, were armed in a different way. If you were in the Western Approaches, the hunting of submarines and the use of ASDIC was the first requirement. The need to fight off fighter aircraft was not so great, so consequently, while they were provided with anti-aircraft guns, this was not in the same number that were found in Home Fleet ships. Consequently, we had ships that were well-armed from the anti-aircraft point of view, well-armed from the others, well-armed from the ASDIC point of view, and also, later than after the peak of 17, small aircraft carriers were sent. But in the case of peak of 17, we had destroyer escort. We also had an escort of two anti-aircraft ships. Now, these were converted merchant ships, which were designed solely to fight off fighter aircraft or bomber aircraft. We had the ships were known as HMS Poza Rica and HMS Palomares, and they were quite fast because they were former banana boats which had been used to convey bananas from the West Indies to the UK, and they were well known before the war because they were much faster than the average run of merchant ships, which perhaps could do 8 or 9 knots if they were doing quite well, whereas I think the Puerto Rican Palomares could at least do 15 knots. All these figures sound very small and slow today, but at that time, a 15-knot ship was pretty useful, particularly if it was armed with a good anti-aircraft
weapon.
Of course, that was the close escort to Pico 17, but beyond that, of course, beyond that, I mean, out of sight, was a force of British cruisers and occasionally battleships, but also American destroyers and cruisers. Now, they were there in case the German high seas fleet appeared, and that only came about very infrequently, but nevertheless, there was the Germans had this force in northern Norway, and consequently the British could not send a convoy anywhere near North Russia unless it was armed sufficiently to fight off the German threat. We survived two or three German air raids. They sent over from aerodromes in northern Norway, which were, of course, Norway was occupied by the Germans for quite a period. And the aircraft came in one huge wave, Heinkel aircraft armed with torpedoes. And it was occasion when the any ship that had an anti-aircraft weapon fired it. And we did put up the PQ-17 escort and the merchant ships as well, which of course were all armed, put up a very good fight against the German aircraft. Nevertheless, some of the torpedoes did get through and some of the ships were sunk, but not many. And the sad part about it was that although the convoy was putting up such a good fight, the outcome of the whole exercise was so disastrous because, of course, on July the 4th, the Admiralty received information that led them to believe that the Tirpitz, German battleship Tirpitz, which was known to be based in northern Norway, was thought to be at sea. There's a very long and intricate story as to how this action took place and why the British Admiralty in London came to the opinion that the Tirpitz was at sea. In point of fact, it did go to sea for a very short period on July the 4th, but returned to harbour. Now, that fact that it returned to harbour was not apparent to the Admiralty, and the Admiralty decided, in the form of Admiral Dudley Pound, that it was unsafe for the convoy to proceed if the Tirpitz was at sea. And orders were given that the convoy should scatter on the theory that if the convoy remained as a coherent whole, it would be attacked both by the Tirpitz and by aircraft and submarines. It would be a very clear target, whereas if it was scattered and you had your 30-odd ships scattered in different directions, the convoy would have a better chance of survival, even if some ships were sunk. It was thought unlikely that they all would be, which would not be the case if they all stayed together. Consequently, late at night on July the 4th, we were given the order to scatter, and this was very badly received by many people on the convoy, because they felt that we were doing well. We had got so far. We were only within at least three days more journey, and we would have been in Archangel. However, orders were orders, and the convoy was scattered. We then made our way independently, as we were instructed, to Archangel. However, our CO, Captain Gradwell, decided that he read the German mind, which is a very methodical mind, to the effect that if the convoy was known to be at point X at 2200 hours on July the 4th when it scattered, the next morning it would be so many miles further on towards Reykjavik, towards Archangel. And consequently, that was the area in which all the submarines and aircraft should be concentrated. Gradwell thought that he would go in the opposite direction from Archangel. In other words, he would go north instead of south. This being a form of self-preservation, I may say. And it was discovered, or we realised, that there were at least two, if not three, American ships, merchant ships, in our vicinity. And they called us up on the oldest signal lamps, and the message came to the effect, could they come along with us? Because the Americans obviously felt happier with an escort with them than going on their own. Gradwell agreed with this, and we made our way slowly northwards in company with three ships. They were known as the SS Troubadour, the SS Ironclad, and the SS Silver Sword. And these were not large ships by today's reckoning, but they were of the range of 5,000 to 8,000 tons, quite small merchant ships, but packed very tightly with weapons of war, aircraft, guns, tanks, ammunition for the Russian forces. And they were very much in demand. The Russians at that time were life was hanging by a thread, and any forces that could help them were welcome with open arms. Well, we made our way north, and of course you can't go very far north in that part of the world. It was in the region of 85 degrees north. You would come across ice, and we did encounter small amounts of small pieces of ice, and gradually it got thicker. And it was clear that we weren't going to go very far, but Grabow's point was that if we went a certain distance into the ice and the ships stopped and didn't make any smoke, the Germans would be busily hunting away to the south each day, going nearer and nearer to Russia, on the assumption that, rather like you're pushing a broom, that they would be following the prey, the merchant ships, and that would be where their attention would be concentrated and not miles away to the north. This gambit proved to be 100% successful because we never saw a single German submarine or aircraft, although we were listening on the radio waves, and of course we heard SOS after SOS after SOS as ships were being attacked and later sunk. Having reached this point of limit of beyond which we could not go because of the ice, the first lieutenant, Lieutenant Elson, suggested that it might be desirable that we can use some of the, we had large stocks of white paint because we were camouflaged with light colours, light blue and light green colours, which required stocks of white paint to be carried on board the ship to be mixed with greens and blues. The idea of the camouflage was that in poor light in northern waters, a ship which was painted variously in light green and light blue was difficult to spot and consequently made us less of a target. So Ayrshire was disguised in this way, and we having got the stocks of white paint, it was decided that if we passed some of these over to the American merchant ships and lying stopped in the ice, if they were painted white on one side only, which would be the side that an enemy would appear from the south, they could tone in much more easily painted white than if they were painted as they were, black or grey or some other such colour. And this is what we did. Stocks of white paint were ferried over to the American merchant ships, and they set about it with a will because they realised that the sooner the ship was painted white, the less likely that any German aircraft coming from the south would see the ice, and beyond it some white objects which could be considered to be icebergs, for example. In other words, he didn't think that it would render them invisible, of course, but that it made them less likely to be spotted in a place where the Germans wouldn't expect to find ships anyway. We stayed there for the best part of 2 to 3 days, and then it was decided, because we could hear what was happening on the radio and that the hunt for the ships was being carried on well to the south of us and going away from us towards Archangel, we then encouraged the American ships to come out of the ice, and we went south into more open water and proceeded east towards a large island which was part of North Russia, called Novaya, N-O-V-A-Y-A, Zemlya, Z-E-M-L-Y-A, and it's called Nova Zembla, I gather. This was about 2 to 3 days' journey, and we made this almost tiptoeing, as you might say, hoping that by not making smoke, not making any noise, not attracting ourselves in any way, the Germans would not spot us. A plane did pass over us in misty weather, and everybody, of course, held their breath in case there was a mast sticking up above the fog bank, which would give us away. But our luck held, and we made landfall on this island. Well, it's quite a long story, but having made the landfall, we then managed to make contact with Archangel. A party was put into a boat from Ayrshire, and Lieutenant Elston went ashore armed with rifles and one Polish-speaking member of one of the American ships, on the theory that spoken Polish and spoken Russian have a similarity, and that at least he would be better able to communicate with the Russians than us English-speaking personnel. This proved to be the case, and when the party reached land, it was adjacent to a lighthouse. This was why the spot was chosen, of course, as there would be personnel, Russian-speaking personnel there. Communication was made with Archangel. And, of course, we weren't alone in being members of a ship's party that had found Nova Zemlya. And we made contact with other American ships and British ships which had ended up in the same place. A force was sent out from Archangel, a small escort force, which of course was formed of part of the original escort of PQ-17. Other members of our escort had reached Archangel a few days earlier. They turned around with a will to come out and help us. And a Russian icebreaker was also sent. Consequently, everybody met up in Nova Zembla, and we formed up with one small little convoy of, I think, about eight vessels, and set off back to finally reach Archangel. And when we got there, we found that there were only 11 ships out of, I think, 33 or 34 ships which had set out from Reykjavik in Iceland, actually made it to Archangel. So out of the 11, the little airship was responsible on its own for ferrying and convoying into Russia three of the ships. So three out of 11 might not have made it unless if we hadn't decided under the guidance of Lieutenant Gradwell, with the help of Lieutenant Elston, to take the Americans under our wing. We were lucky that the gamble came off, but there you are. It's something had to go right after that very unfortunate incident of the scattering of the convoy in July the 4th.
Do you feel at all bitter about the scatter order?
I feel that it was very unfortunate, but one could appreciate the fact that people sat in London had not got definite evidence one way or the other, and Captain Pound, although there were people there on his staff, very able people who were able to deduce in a sort of Sherlock Holmes type of way that if this hadn't happened, then the other might have happened. It was a matter of assessing possibilities and probabilities, and of course, with hindsight, it's perfectly obvious that the Tirpitz was not the threat that it was thought to be, but one must assume that people are human and that they had the facts before them, and one man it was in charge, and he took the decision. He didn't take the right decision, but then a great many other people might have done exactly the same thing based on the evidence that he had. Given all the instruments and apparatus that's available today in the form of radar and satellites and all the rest of it, such sort of things would not happen. But one must remember that in 1942, the facilities available to him were very, very much less than they would be today.
How did your own job aboard the ship go?
Oh, it was very interesting, of course, being on duty from midnight to 4 a.m. and it was brilliant daylight. Being in an area for several weeks and not seeing any darkness, and going below to go to sleep, and it was still broad daylight, it was a strange thing to happen. It didn't disrupt us too much. Well, obviously, it took a little bit of getting used to. We were, as usual, not terribly well placed as regards food. We had dried food, tinned food, no milk, and the diet wasn't very brilliant. And of course, when we got to Russia,